It's 6 hours Universal Time. Stay tuned for Daybreak Africa coming up after these latest world news headlines.
A horrific discovery aboard a migrant boat from North Africa. Hope and controversy among African teams at the World Cup. I'm Victor Beatty reporting from Washington. According to Italian news agencies, some 30 bodies were found Sunday in a migrant boat which was stopped between Sicily and the North African coast. Italian rescuers making the discovery after boarding the vessel, which carried nearly 600 refugees and migrants to evacuate those in distress, including two pregnant women. The French press agency says more than 1,600 migrants were rescued by Italian authorities over the weekend, bringing to more than 60,000 rescued this year. Meanwhile, Israeli authorities broke up a protest by hundreds of African migrants who marched out of a detention center protesting their conditions. The mostly Eritrean and Sudanese migrants say Israel has not processed their asylum requests. Some 50,000 Africans have poured into Israel in recent years, insisting they're fleeing persecution and danger. Suspected Islamist militants attacked churches in several towns in northeast Nigeria Sunday, leaving at least 24 dead. Witnesses and local officials said the gunmen on motorcycles hit the villages near Sunday near Chibok in Borno State. There has been no immediate claim of responsibility. The violence is the latest in a regular series of attacks in northeast Nigeria that has continued despite the government's declaring of a state of emergency and sending extra troops to the region. Costa Rica and the Netherlands reached the quarterfinals of football's World Cup in Brazil Sunday. Costa Rica shocking Greece 5-3 in a penalty kick shootout. The Netherlands stunned Mexico with two late goals in a 2-1 victory. Two more quarterfinals are determined today, with Nigeria facing France and Germany taking on Algeria. John Obi Mikel is a Nigerian midfielder.
It's going to be a very spectacular game. Is going to be a very important game for both sides. I think details might decide the game. So we have to be very, very cautious and concentrate on every details and make sure we do what we have to do to win the game tomorrow.
He says he hopes his team will help reunite Nigeria, gripped by violence. Nigeria has beaten the Bosnians, scored a draw with Iran, but lost to Argentina 3-2. Meanwhile, Ghana's captain, Asamoah Gyan, apologized Sunday for the collapse of the Black Stars in Brazil. They finished at the bottom of their group, losing to the United States, holding Germany to a draw, but losing to Portugal. Meanwhile, Cameroon's team, the Indomitable Lions, face a restructuring after a dismal performance in Brazil, where they, too, finished at the bottom of their group, giving up 9 goals against 3 teams. The UN Children's Fund says Sudan today is home to one of the biggest children's crises in the world. Lisa Schlein reports UNICEF says conflict, displacement, and underdevelopment are placing large numbers of children at risk.
Representative in Sudan for the UN Children's Fund, Geert Capilleri, says 1.2 million people are still displaced and another 400,000 have become newly displaced this year. About 65% of these internally displaced people are under the age of 18. He says many of these children have grown up in Darfur displacement camps. He says they are in danger of becoming a lost generation if they are unable to escape from this life. He calls the situation of most of the children dire and says children are seriously affected by a number of conflicts in the country. The government of Sudan and rebel factions continue to fight in Darfur, but unlike 10 years ago, he says intertribal clashes are growing.
Of course, we have also still the war going on in the southern states of Sudan, the Kordofan states, Blue Nile, where we have an estimated 500,000 kids we haven't been able to access for the last 3 years.
Capilleri says the children in these states have not been vaccinated against killer diseases for years and are at high risk. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
A Tunisian diplomat and an embassy staffer abducted in Libya early this year were freed Sunday by their abductors, both men kidnapped in separate incidents. The Tunisian diplomat had been taken 2 days after the Jordanian ambassador to Tripoli was abducted. The murder trial of South African runner Oscar Pistorius resumes today after a month of mental evaluations to determine if an anxiety disorder could have influenced his actions the night he killed his girlfriend. The evaluation was ordered after a psychiatrist testified for the defense. Pistorius had an anxiety disorder that could have contributed to the killing of Reeva Steenkamp. In the early hours of February 14, 2013, Pistorius claimed he mistook her for an intruder and shot her through a bathroom door. I'm Victor Beatty, VOA News.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
morning, Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Monday, June 30th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. Another workers' strike looms in South Africa.
The purpose of the strike is to force the employers to concede to the workers' demands, because employers had arrogantly placed their own demands before they could concede on workers' demands.
Vuyo Lufele is the Secretary General of the National Union of Metal Workers of South Africa for Western Cape Province. A petition to dissolve the management of the Kenyan Independent Electoral Commission has been made. Thousands flee attacks in the Central African Republic, and Darfur rebels acknowledge the death of their leaders.
When they are pulling out from the battle, they fall in an ambush by the South Sudan Armed Forces to come and try to rescue and to assist those dangers who are being beaten by our people.
Abdulaziz Sam is assistant to the chairman for communication and human rights of the Sudan Liberation Movement. Zimbabwe's ruling party accuses opposition MDC members of parliament of not carrying out government policies in Matabeleland North. And civil rights pioneers remember the struggle for equal rights in the United States. Those stories plus Mark Oldman's sports and our listener of the day are coming up on Daybreak Africa. Just days following the end of South Africa's longest strike ever by the Association of Mine Workers and Construction Union, the National Union of Metal Workers of South Africa, NUMSA, announced on Sunday that its 200,000 members will go on strike beginning July 1st. Vuyo Lufele, Secretary General for NUMSA in Western Cape Province, says the purpose of the strike is to force management to meet the workers' demand for a wage increase of 12%. Lufele tells me that unless South African workers unite to fight against unjust wages, they will never benefit from the economy of their country.
The purpose of the strike is to force the employers to concede to the workers' demands, because employers had arrogantly placed their own demands before they could concede on workers' demands. And if this agreement is signed, then there will be no further negotiations on any other issue in the workplace. They want to change 1677 of our own main agreement. And they are placing a number of demands, and the different employers have displayed different attitudes. As we normally negotiate with employers as a collective, now there are different employer organizations that are placing different demands, and we have got no choice but to go on strike for workers to have better wages. And for now, they are offering 7% for the highest paid and 8% for the lowest paid. But they are saying that offer is with conditions, that we must also agree to their own demands. And therefore, we have got no choice but to go on strike.
You're demanding a 12% wage increase. Some economists will say, well, that is too much. That is almost double the inflation rate of 6.6%. Do you feel your demand is too high?
I think employers should appreciate that we are still demanding in percentage, not in a rand like mine workers. That attitude of telling us about inflation rate, workers know nothing about inflation rate. Only what they see is their conditions. Where they still stay in shacks. They don't have decent houses. Some, they don't even have houses at all. And even in the workplace, their working conditions are unbearable. They are exposed to so much unhealthy and unsafety environment. And therefore, they've got no choice but to also uplift their living conditions, their living standards, by ensuring that they demand the best out of these employers, because they are making millions out of this country.
Now, do you think all the workers, all members of the union are on board?
All our members are on board, and you will see on the 1st of July, metal workers on the street in their red t-shirts.
South Africa just had the conclusion of another strike, the longest in the history of the country, at platinum mines. Why are all these strikes now in South Africa?
You see, the challenge that we are faced with, we've got government that now is advancing economic policies that have no interest of workers in this country. And it's clear that unless workers organize themselves, united, and make sure that they make concrete demands so that we fight against these neoliberal policies that our own government is advancing, we will never have workers benefiting from the economy of this country.
Vuyo Lufele is the Secretary General for the National Union of Metal Workers of South Africa, Western Cape Province. He was speaking with me from Cape Town. A Kenyan citizen has petitioned Parliament to dissolve the management of the Independent Electoral and Boundaries Commission after the main opposition accused the electoral body of incompetence and failure to administer credible election. But Commissioner Yusuf Nzibo tells reporter Peter Clotty the petitioner misapplied the constitutional provision that enables a commissioner to be fired over incompetence.
We found mischief in how the petition was done. Following the outcome of the Supreme Court decision that the elections by large were conducted in a free and fair and credible manner, and we feel that the man, even though used Article 251 that talks about the grounds for one's removal, that he did not go for a particular person. He did a collective petition, which is not provided in the Constitution. You cannot call for the removal and the constituting of a tribunal for the removal of the whole commission. You can do it for an individual commissioner if they have violated that Article 251 of the Constitution.
So in the future, how does the Electoral Commission plan to ensure that all parties are represented in its activities to ensure an equal level playing field and transparency in the administration of the election itself?
Let's look at the history of the 2013 election. This was the first election after the new Constitution. We were holding six elections, elective positions, on one day. The Constitution called for elections to be held on one day. That is for the presidency, members of National Assembly, members of Senate, women representatives, governor, and county assembly members. Of course, in the first election of this kind, of this nature, I don't think there's any country in Africa that has held six elections on one day, 11 hours. You know, so there were bound to be challenges, and in fact, we experienced challenges with technology because a lot of the procurement was done late, and therefore the training had not been done properly, the government had to intervene, and the government was basically involved in the procurement of the biometric voter registration, which was very successful.
Can the Electoral Commission basically promise Kenyans of a better organized election come 2017 that you and Kenyans will be satisfied with across board?
Let me correct the impression that has been created. One is the issue of perception. Not a single case someone has come and said the election results declared in a polling station were different from, like in 2007, from those that were announced at the national level. So basically, the opposition was using the issue of failure of transmission of results to argue that the results were not credible. But remember, at every polling station, they were supposed to have had agents. We issued certificates, and we've tabled documents to Parliament to show how each position was contested and the results. And nobody has challenged those results. And following the results of the Supreme Court decision, we've gone ahead even and calculated to show in each area how many Kenyans were eligible to vote, sorry, to register, how many registered, how many of those turned up to vote. And there's a pattern here. You know, you can see very clearly, for one reason or another, there were areas where there was very high turnout for registration, there was very high turnout for voting.
Yusuf Nzibo is a member of Kenya's Independent Electoral and Boundaries Commission. He was speaking with reporter Peter Clotty from the capital, Nairobi. An official of a rebel group in Sudan's Darfur region has confirmed the death of Ali Kabino, leader of the Sudan Liberation Movement for Justice. Abdulaziz Sam is assistant to the chairman for communication and human rights for the Sudan Liberation Movement, headed by Mini Minawi. He says Kabino had led an attack by a joint rebel force against Janjaweed militias who had attacked and looted the property of civilians. Sam tells me that while returning from their defeat of the Janjaweed, the joint rebel force was ambushed by the Sudan armed forces.
Because some civilians complained that these Janjaweed are attacking the places of the settlements and looting their property, and even they are raping some women. So to respond to this provocation, we joined forces from the free movement, who is the one led by Ali Kabino, who is killed. This joint force, they go and destroy that camp where the authorities are committed. And when they are pulling out from the battle, they fall in an ambush by the staff, Sudan Armed Forces, to come and try to rescue and to assist those Janjaweed who are being beaten by our people.
Why do you think it's necessary to continue the fight in Darfur? What do the rebels want?
Where are defending our people, because our people are attacked continuously by the Janjaweed people and the government people, air bombardment and from the ground. Also, all is there as their forces patrolling and moving towards the people of Darfur. So we must defend our people. We are carrying out a defensive war, and nobody is defending our people. The national community is just silent. We are not even condemning or making statements against this government forces and its allying militias.
Do you want to have an independent state in Darfur?
No. We are fighting to liberate our people and ourselves from the culture of this Islamic regime. We never even ever talk about any type of separation or secession of any part of the Sudan. No, we are trying to unify Sudan because we are one nation. We are not going to separate any part of this country. We are going to take this regime to be accountable in front of the national and international criminal court. This is our issue and this is our battle and this is our mission.
The government of President Omar al-Bashir is calling for national dialogue. Would the rebels be willing to join?
Nothing, neither national dialogue under fire, under bombardment, under killing, under these people are killing our people. The air forces of the SAP are bombarding in support of this militia. What sort of dialogue? Nothing is called dialogue in this situation. So there must be the cessation of hostilities. There must be mechanisms. There must be intervention of the international community. The Security Council must interfere, you know, to enhance the situation. And then after that, there must be negotiations between the government and the movement in the issues that we are fighting for. The issues like identity of Sudan. How is Sudan to be a system of governance? After that, all the stakeholders and the civil society and political parties can come to a national dialogue in the minor issues.
Abdelaziz Sam is assistant to the chairman for communication and human rights of the Sudan Liberation Movement, headed by Mini Minawi. He was speaking with me from Uganda's capital, Kampala. You're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Daybreak Africa time is coming up at 17 and a half minutes past the hour. The UN Refugee Agency says thousands of people have fled from deadly attacks by various groups of armed men in the Central African Republic town of Bambari. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from UNHCR headquarters in Geneva.
Tensions have been at a boiling point in Bambari since May, when widespread fighting displaced more than 13,000 people. On Monday, armed elements attacked a Muslim displacement camp south of the city. Other armed men and the civilian population then retaliated. UNHCR spokeswoman Melissa Fleming says at least 45 people have been killed and scores wounded in the attacks and counterattacks. She says the violence has prompted thousands of people to flee the town, which lies about 380 kilometers northeast of Bangui, the capital of CAR.
Our staff there say the town of Bambari has been reduced to a ghost city. They say that Christian neighborhoods have been virtually emptied of residents from previous attacks, while displacement sites are packed with people struggling to get by. And of course, to compound it all, we have the rainy season making things even more miserable.
Fleming says people urgently need better protection, shelter, water and sanitation, as well as food and other items. She says the UNHCR and its partners are doing their best to fulfill these needs, but the volatile security situation is making it difficult to operate. She says the delivery of humanitarian assistance is also being hampered by fears that the cycle of revenge attacks soon will pick up again. In addition to internal displacement, Fleming tells VOA, more people continue to flee into neighboring countries.
We're seeing that the conditions of people coming in are just absolutely despicable. I mean, in terms of human frailty, what is being done to them, people with machete wounds, huge numbers of malnourished. This we've been reporting to you for the past several months, and it continues. So a reflection of a really just horrific situation inside the Central African Republic, where the state is not in control and where the fighting continues unabated.
The latest UNHCR figures show nearly 140,000 people from CAR have sought refuge in Cameroon, Democratic Republic of Congo, Chad, and the Republic of Congo in the last 6 months. It says most of the refugees are in Cameroon, where last week the UNHCR registered another 3,000 people. The agency says the number displaced inside Central African Republic is even higher, 536,500 people. More than 111,000 of them are living in 43 sites in Bangui. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
In Zimbabwe, the Movement for Democratic Change Formation of former Prime Minister Morgan Tsvangirai says it will not be disturbed by a recent ZANU-PF decision to deploy its top officials in Matabeleland North Province to monitor the performance of MDCT members of the House of Assembly. At its recent workshop in Bulawayo, ZANU-PF officials accused the opposition MPs of not implementing some government programs in the province. But MDCT spokesman Douglas Mwanzura says his party is not an extension of the ruling ZANU-PF.
Definitely that is absolute nonsense, because the members of parliament for MDC do represent DC and the people in the constituents. They do not represent ZANU-PF, and therefore are not there to implement ZANU-PF programs. They are there to implement MDC programs in conjunction with the people of Zimbabwe. Therefore, it is not necessary for the members of Parliament of the MDC to be monitored by ZANU-PF. But we know that ZANU-PF is arrogant. They are bed losers. They just want to make sure that they want to impose themselves on the people of Zimbabwe. We will not respect that.
But as members of parliament, are you not expected to also implement government policies? And ZANU-PF happens to be the party that's in the government.
Well, we implement policies that make sense. Zim Asset doesn't make sense at all. Zim Asset so far does not mean jobs. It does not mean more industries. It does not mean prosperity. It does not mean moving the people of Zimbabwe from poverty and misery. Zim Asset simply means maintenance of the status quo. There is nothing to learn and there is nothing to implement.
What are you going to do in the event that ZANU-PF starts its monitoring program?
Well, the monitoring does not matter at all, does not make sense, because whether it monitors us and gives us a 0 out of 10, they can't do anything about it, because we are the legitimate members of parliament in those areas. So we do not care about whether ZANU-PF monitors us and whatever mark it gives us.
Douglas Mwanzura is the spokesman for the MDC formation of former Prime Minister Morgan Tsvangirai. He was speaking with reporter Jonga Kandemiri of VOA Zimbabwe program. Many people across the United States are this week marking the 50th anniversary of the signing of the 1964 Civil Rights Act into law. The sweeping piece of legislation outlawed discrimination based on race and ended racial segregation in schools, the workplace, and in public accommodations. The law one final passage on July 2, 1964, after years of civil rights protests in which people lost their lives. Viewers Chris Simpkins introduces us to two women who were on the front lines of the protest movement that changed the country forever.
Today I want to say to the people of America and the nations of the world, we're on the move and no wave of racism can stop us.
Millions marched around the country for equal rights led by Martin Luther King during the 1960s. It was a cause that brought Dorie Lattner and Joan Mulholland together more than 50 years ago. They met in racially segregated Mississippi. It was Dorie's first experience working with a white woman in the civil rights movement.
She was also interested in the plight of not only my people, but her people as well, to erase this evil segregation that was bothering all of us. I found it phenomenal and I embraced her.
Joan and Dorie stayed in the same dormitory at Tougaloo College in Jackson, Mississippi, and participated in civil rights demonstrations there. Joan was even arrested twice for her actions, but it didn't stop her.
I learned in church about do unto others as you would have them do unto you. And then in high school, we had to memorize the Declaration of Independence. We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal. Practice what we preach. And that's what propelled me into it.
I have a dream that one day...
The two took part in the 1963 March on Washington. Less than a month later, four black girls were killed in a racially motivated church bombing in Birmingham, Alabama. Both women attended the funerals.
It had a profound impact on me, and it made me more determined to try and eradicate this evil that was permeating throughout our society.
Get the country realizing that change had to come.
More than five decades later, the women are sharing their experiences with younger generations around the country. They tell them that one of their proudest moments came when President Lyndon Johnson signed the 1964 Civil Rights Act, which outlawed discrimination and ended racial segregation.
The students took it to the streets, and the lawyers took it to the courts, and the press took it to the world. And didn't anybody do it by themselves?
The passage of the Civil Rights Bill was one of the things that we fought for, and has brought about a new day, what we would call social change to a large extent, change in the laws of the country, change in the attitudes of the people.
Dorian Jones say despite coming from different backgrounds, they will always share a special bond, one that's endured through the struggles and victories of the Civil Rights Movement. Chris Simpkins, VOA News, Washington.
It's time now for Daybreak Africa Sports, and here is Mark Ouma in Johannesburg, South Africa. Good Monday morning to you, Mark.
Good morning, James. In our Daybreak Africa Sports News, we focus on the FIFA World Cup in Brazil. A 10-man Costa Rican side stood firm to eliminate Greece in an energy-sapping encounter in Recife on Sunday. After playing to a 1-1 deadlock in 120 minutes of open play, Costa Rica edged Greece 5-3 in post-match penalty shootouts. Costa Rica's hard-fought victory means they'll make their first appearance in a World Cup quarterfinals. Earlier on, Netherlands bounced back from a goal down to pip Mexico 2-1 in Fortaleza. Meanwhile, in earlier second-round knockout matches on Saturday, Colombia eliminated South American champions Uruguay 2-1 in Rio de Janeiro, while hosts Brazil required a post-match penalty shootout to prevail over a resilient Chile 5-4 in Belo Horizonte. The two sides initially played to a 1-1 draw in open play. Staying in Brazil, fans across the continent look forward to a two-pronged quest for a landmark double African qualification into the quarterfinals today, Monday. First up are the African champions Nigeria Super Eagles, who tackle France in Belo Horizonte. Nigeria aim to advance to the last eight for the first time in their history. Perhaps the most emotional encounter will feature Africa's highest-placed side on the current FIFA rankings, the Algerian Desert Fox, who engage Germany in Porto Alegre. Algeria aimed to bury the ghost of the 1982 World Cup in Spain, where after beating the fancied West Germans 2-1, they were, along with many other Africans, infuriated by the dull, scoreless draw between West Germany and their neighbors, Austria. The result meant Algeria were eliminated amid widespread anger that the European neighbors were allegedly involved in match fixing. Subsequently, FIFA ruled that all last group fixtures are played simultaneously so as to protect the integrity of their competitions. This has since been adopted at major football competitions worldwide. And that's it for Daybreak Africa Sports News. I'm Mark Ouma in Johannesburg, South Africa. Back to you, James, in Washington.
Thank you, Mark. Have a good day. And that's it for this Monday, June 30th edition of Daybreak Africa. We thank you for starting this week with us. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, producer Jackson Vunganyi, reporters Peter Clotty and Ricky Stryak, as well as sports editor Mark Ouma, along with our engineer Carl Sterling, I'm James Button in Washington, wishing everybody in Africa a very productive week.